with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And we are recording this in the age of coronavirus, and so we're all in our separate homes, but that's how we record this anyway, so it's no different than normal.
Right.
No different than normal. So we are socially engaging across the miles, keeping our distance,
yes,
our physical distance, but emotional connection. And
isn't it
connection.
Amazing what we can do now? I mean, you can see people. You know when you call them, you can see their face. I mean, it's fantastic. It really is.
It is. It's true. This was certainly a lot easier than it would have been if we'd had to do this 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, indeed.
So I don't know if our listeners know, Mom, that you are a guitarist and have been for many, many years and have taught how many people to play guitar over the years?
I don't know, but yeah, I started with piano and then I played violin. And then I played the harp in college, which was the most fantastic thing. And then your dad's roommate was a folk singer, and so he gave me my first guitar, and I started guitar. So I have been, you know, music for a long time, since I was 5 years old, and I'm still enjoying it,
And you've been teaching since, what, you were 30 maybe, teaching guitar and piano? I mean, I remember I was pretty young when you started teaching, and definitely hundreds of students.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure I have, yeah.
So, and we have, the reason we're talking about this is because our guest today, Dave Isaacs, is the author of The Perpetual Beginner, A Musician's Path to Lifelong Learning. A native of New York, Dave Isaacs is a musician, performing songwriter, and teacher based in Nashville. He holds a Master of Music degree from the Manhattan School of Music, and he earned the moniker the Guitar Guru of Music Row for his work with aspiring and professional musicians, songwriters, and performing artists in Nashville. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Dave.
Thanks for having me on. And, you know, I was listening to you thinking about the way that we can communicate now. And when you said it would have been so much harder 50 years ago, and my thought was right. Only Dick Tracy could do this 50 years ago.
That is true. That is true. And
right.
And Captain Kirk, maybe.
Yes, yes.
Although I don't know. That actually, 50. When did Star Trek start? Was
it was about.
It probably was. It
yeah.
probably was, because I think it was on when I was a kid, and that would be, you know, about that time.
He's not going to tell you how old he is, I see.
Yeah.
So, Dave, tell us a little bit about, and guitar is your instrument. Tell us a little
yes.
bit about how you became a guitarist.
Well, my mother insists that it was my idea. Seems to me I remember it was hers, but we must have had a discussion about it. So I was about 14, and typical suburban kid, summer comes along. What are you going to do with yourself? You're not just going to roam around the neighborhood all summer. So she said, go to camp. I said, no, I don't want to go to camp. I was not the most social kid. And she says that she remembers my saying, I want to play guitar. I remember her suggesting it, but I'll take her word for it. Either way. So it was really just a casual thing, but I had started to, I grew up around a lot of music. My father played the guitar. My mother played the piano. And so there was always a lot of music in the house. It was important to them. So I grew up with it being important, although I wasn't really aware of popular music so much. My parents were 50s, 60s folkies. And so, you know, my mom had both Limelighters and Pete Seeger records, and she grew up in Eastern Kentucky. So, she loved the mountain music and the Appalachian music. So I heard a lot of Gene Ritchie growing up, and Doc Watson and people like that. And then I guess when I was 12 or 13 is when I discovered first AM radio and then FM radio. And then I started really getting into music. So I guess by the time I picked up the guitar, I was already pretty deeply into it as a listener, as a fan, and just took to it very quickly. It was just, I mean, I fell in love with it right away, which is when I do some reading later, I'll probably pull that part from the book because that's exactly what it was. I just became obsessed.
Mom, did you have that experience with music too? Where you were really obsessed with it when you were younger?
See, when I was a kid, everybody, girls, took piano lessons. All my friends. We had a lot of piano teachers in our fairly small town, and everybody took piano lessons. That was just what you did. and then, you know, I got in fourth grade, started the violin, and so I guess you could say obsessed. I've been obsessed all my life, but I don't think anything has, except perhaps my family, has brought me more pleasure than music. So, yeah, it can become an obsession, but it's a grand one. It really is.
So, Dave, what part of New York were you living in?
Long Island.
Long Island. So here's kind of an interesting or funny coincidence, sort of coincidence. So the man who my mother referred to that introduced her to the guitar was also from Long Island. His name was Dan Isaacson.
Yeah.
And he was very involved in the folk music scene in the 50s and 60s. His sister had an apartment in Greenwich Village, which was a hangout for people like Bob Dylan. And everyone, he met everyone. And I can't remember if it was Pete Seeger who he actually, I think it might have been Pete Seeger, or there was who told him at one point when he asked if he asked for advice about trying to make a living as a musician, and he said, keep your day job. You know, you're good, but that's not the issue. You know, it's just so hard. And he did record an album. But he taught a lot of people to play guitar. He was a music teacher, and he taught at an academy there. He actually taught math too, so he taught at a Woodmere Academy, I think it was called. And
that is so funny because my wife went to Woodmere Academy.
You're kidding?
Really? Oh my gosh!
In the would have been mid '60s or early mid.
That would have been when he was teaching there.
Oh, Lord. I have to ask her if she remembers that name. I mean, she was really young, like grade school, so I don't know if she would remember music teacher or not.
Wow. But, I think he was teaching math at the school, but he might have been teaching music, too. I don't really know. But his son, who is a very good friend of mine, Laurie Isaacson, is a professor at Berkeley up in up in Boston. He was at the Boston Conservatory. And then it joined, you know, Berkeley and the Boston Conservatory merged. And so he's there. And he was actually working on a book recently that about the business side of music for classically trained musicians and how to actually make a living doing this. So this is and you are also classically trained.
I am.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that and how that has influenced the writing of this book.
Okay. Well, I started classical guitar when I told my parents and my guitar teacher that I had decided I was serious about guitar and I really wanted to do this for a living. And my first guitar teacher, Andy Polin, was a wonderful player. Another guy who had come up through that New York City folky scene and had learned from a lot of the greats who were around in that period. And he said to me, well, if you want to go to school for music, you're going to have to play classical guitar or no one will take you seriously. Well, little did I know that that wasn't going to help and that the traditionalists weren't going to take it seriously anyway. But so I took to it because I said, okay, this is what I'm going to study. And my dad had dabbled in classical and flamenco. My father was a doctor. He'd gone to medical school in Europe, in Holland. And while he was over there, he discovered the Spanish guitar and flamenco. And so he had stacks of sheet music. And I don't remember him playing very much of it. I don't think he ever got very adept at it, but it was around. So it was something that I was familiar with. And I was also, so this is the early to mid 80s. So pretty typical for a suburban boy of that age around that time. I'm listening to a lot of hard rock. And a lot of those guitarists were trained or at least dabbling in the classical guitar. So it was connected to something that I was already listening to, although I didn't listen to classical music specifically. And I think, and I talk about this in the book as well, I think I liked the idea of being a classical musician, because as much as I wanted to be all rock and roll, I wanted to be sophisticated too. And I did a better job hanging out with the sophisticated kids than I did trying to be rock and roll and hanging out and with those kids, because I was never quite bad A enough. I think they knew I was kind of faking it. I was trying to figure out how to be cool, and because of the guitar, they accepted me. Because the guitar made me cool, but I think they kind of knew. So there was something about the sophistication, the sense of being advanced, of being a student of classical music that appealed to me, even though it was still something that I studied and I thought I loved it, but in retrospect, I didn't love it the way I loved playing other music. But it was also part of the expectation. Like you mentioned Berkeley in Boston. I wanted to go to Berkeley when I was in high school. And I went actually and spent a summer program there when I was in high school and loved it. But my folks insisted we would prefer you go to a university and actually have a liberal arts education, but you can study music. And so I ended up at the Hart School of Music at the University of Hartford, which had a fantastic guitar program. And that kind of locked a lot of things in for me because I was meeting professional musicians, guitarists who were as cool as any of the rockers I knew because they were just so good at what they did. But at the same time, there was this reverence they had for the music that I really appreciated. And that was something that really drew me in. I remember – oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't think I even knew as a kid that it was possible to go to college and study guitar. Not that I would have. I played guitar slightly. My best instrument was the baritone horn, which has very little career potential. But I didn't – it never would have occurred to me that you could go to college to study guitar.
It was a fairly new development still in the 80s. I mean, that program had developed over a number of years, but pretty much everybody who was teaching there had come up through that school and essentially started the guitar department. I have a good friend, Andy Ellis, who is a wonderful guitarist and a music journalist. He was a senior editor at Guitar Player magazine, Premier Guitar. Has interviewed pretty much anybody you could ever think of. But he went to Berkeley in the early 70s, and he said it was still something of a of an unusual thing to be a guitar student, even though they had guitar as an instrument they offered. And even I recently read a book about the great jazz guitarist Pat Metheny, and he was offered a scholarship to the University of Miami at 18 in 1973. Three or whatever it was. And there was no guitar program. There was no path to follow. And over the course of the 70s is where I think that solidified. So by the time I was in college and graduate school, there were established programs and you had classes in guitar pedagogy and things like that. So, you know, you don't have 200, 300, 400 years of pedagogical history with a few exceptions. So you go study violin, you go study piano, and that foundation is rock solid. With the guitar, it's gotten to that point now, I think. But it was still a fairly new thing. Although, by the time, so I started at the Hart School in 1985, and there were probably 25 guitarists. And about the same, maybe a little bit more, at Manhattan School when I got there 6 years later. So it was a fairly flourishing thing by that point. Now, the making a living part, you mentioned teaching classical musicians how to monetize things. That is one thing that I wish we had had a lot more of at Manhattan School, or just sort of more career-oriented things, because it was a performance program. And they kicked your butt, and it was great for developing the skills. But then you got out there, and it was, okay, what comes next? And the thing that was fortunate for me, though, was I guess I had something of an entrepreneurial mindset even then, because I wanted to perform more. You know, if you were a student, you didn't have to do more than your required X number of recitals and ensemble performances and so forth. But I was going out and booking church halls and giving recitals and trying to find places to play. And I would bring friends with me, and four or five of us would put on a concert, rent a hall, charge admission, and see if we could get some people in. So my teacher at Manhattan School was calling me Diaghilev, because he said, you're the impresario of the group here. So at least I had some idea of, you're going to have to find places to play and figure out how to actually monetize this so you can make a living at it. So there was that, but at the same time, there's not much in the way of real career guidance. There is now a lot more, but there wasn't then.
Right. And in your book, you write about practicing in 5-6 hours a day or more.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, I mean, if you hadn't gone to school for this, do musicians who don't go to school, do they put in that type of practice, those hours and hours and hours, do you think?
They say John Coltrane would fall asleep with his horn in his hand. So yes, certainly the best, the most obsessed. I've heard Pat Metheny say the same thing at a certain point in his life. And still, as accomplished as he is, still says that he needs to warm up for about 2 hours before he feels like he's ready for a concert. I think the difference is that as a student, I learned how to practice effectively, how to organize my time, how to problem solve. And the thing that I see as a teacher now is that that's the single biggest thing that people are missing, is their idea of practicing is just keep going for it, keep going for it, keep going for it. And it does work in the long term. But most of my students are adults. Everyone's got limited time and limited energy. And so being efficient becomes that much more important. And you can accomplish more in an hour of concentrated, thoughtful practice than you can in 4 hours of just sitting and moving your hands.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Dave Isaacs, author of The Perpetual Beginner, A Musician's Path to Lifelong Learning. So, Dave, who is this book for?
This book is for anyone that wants to, how should I put it? I'll back up for a second. I recognized, I would say about 5 years ago, that the vast majority of my students, and as I said, I'm working primarily with adults now, had played the instrument for a number of years, some for 20 or 30 or more, but didn't feel that they had improved since very early on. So people would say things like, well, I picked up the guitar 20 years ago, but I'm still a beginner. And in starting to look at that, I started thinking about, well, what does it take to make somebody feel like I'm no longer a beginner? What does that mean? And to me, what that means is that you become confident in at least fundamental things. And I write in the book about an experience I had going from a bebop workshop with a bunch of jazz aficionados to a folk music retreat. and being struck by the fact that at the folk music retreat, 20 people could sit in a circle and play a song they'd never heard. And at the jazz workshop, the students, at least, had a hard time not stepping over each other when they played two or three at a time. And I was trying to keep up with these folkies. And here I am at this point. I was about to start graduate school. And I'm thinking I'm a sophisticated musician. And yet I'm working to keep up with these people playing three-chord songs because they had so much authority in what they did. And so in starting to think about, well, what does it take to actually build authority? And so the book is for the people that feel like their skills don't match up to their years, to the time that they've put into it. But the ideas really expand to anybody. And what was really striking is that while I was working on the book, I got into a rut myself and wrote the last chapter specifically about, well, what did I do to get myself back into it, which just demonstrates that no matter how skilled you may be, that the ideas are applicable.
I want to back up a minute and about getting to practice. I used to tell my students that practicing every day, if only for 10, 15 minutes, was better than practicing for an hour once a week.
Exactly. And,
yeah. Because that you're training, you're not just training, you're training your brain and you're training your hands. And there are times when my brain doesn't tell me how to play this certain thing, but my hands will do it. I don't know how that works.
Right.
But yeah, this practicing thing, of course, kids, you know, when kids start out, like I get kids in fourth, fifth grade, and then they're real, you know, interested in this. Then they get into sports and they lose interest in, you know, practicing music, which is sad. But I have never heard anybody say they were glad that they stopped taking lessons.
Right.
I heard a lot of people say they were sorry they stopped taking lessons.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
I mean,
that's interesting.
I don't know if you've experienced this with working with the kids that you work with, but one of the problems that I always had, particularly if you were working in, let's say, more affluent neighborhoods where the expectations on the kids are very high, that they're raised to be achievers. And so you would have kids that were on three teams and playing two instruments. And I had a 10-year-old say to me once, "I'm only 10. I'm not supposed to be stressed out," which is absolutely true. So
yeah.
They become overloaded, and it's hard to reach that obsessive point, maybe that's the wrong word, but let's say devoted point, that's going to really make you do the work to master something when you're trying to take in so many things. But it's absolutely true that I've never heard somebody say, "I'm really glad I quit." Although I did play the flute for about 6 months in fifth grade, and I can't tell you that I felt like I should have kept that up because I was not good at it.
But you could probably still get a couple tunes out of it if you had to.
I don't know. I definitely struggled with it. I mean, so it's funny, Monica. You mentioned everyone. I'm sorry. Maybe it was. I don't remember which of you said that everybody took piano lessons, but
it was me.
Yeah, that I was okay with piano lessons when I found a teacher. My mother, rather, found a teacher that let me play by ear, and then I really enjoyed it. But when I first started, it was because my friends were taking piano lessons, so I went and did it too. And then I had two or three friends that were playing the flute in fifth grade in band, and so I went and did it too. But I did it because they were doing it, and I just remember struggling with it. I still, though, it would be nice to have a wind instrument in the repertoire. I came to appreciate those much later, I would say. Like, now I love a horn. I didn't know from horns when I was a teenager.
Okay, let me ask you about playing by ear. I know this young man who plays by ear, and he wanted to learn how to read music. So I was trying to teach him that. And then his job got conflicting with, he couldn't take any more lessons. But I have always been amazed by people who can play by ear. That's got to be a God-given talent. It's not something that you can develop, is it? Isn't it? Aren't you born with it?
Well, and in the book I talk about this as well. The whole God-given talent question is interesting because I know that I had a good ear in the sense that when I was a kid, I could sit down and plink out a melody with one finger. And I also know, though, that over the course of my training, I had very specific work that I was expected to do to develop my ear. And I also know that as a teenager, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to play guitar parts. We didn't have the resources we have now. We didn't have YouTube. We didn't have all these things on the internet and video lessons and so forth. So it was a lot of just drop the needle and try to figure out where that note was. And by the time I got to college, I was significantly ahead of a lot of my peers in ear training class because I had done that work. Whereas when it came to reading, the kids who had been in orchestra since fifth grade and band could read circles around me. So I do believe that the ear is something that you can develop because I've studied enough ear training. And I've also seen just over the years, both in my own musicianship and as a teacher, that a lot of listening just starts with deciding to listen and knowing what to listen for. You know, it's really interesting. I don't know if, and you can tell me if you've experienced this the same way, but I feel like we listen in layers. And most people are hearing only the surface details of a song. They're hearing the singing and the words, and they're probably feeling the beat, but are not aware of the instruments unless something is really prominent. And then as you continue to listen, you start to pick out more details. For example, because I was so focused on the guitar, when I was listening to music as a teenager and young 20-something, I was aware of other instruments, and I might notice a bass part, a drum part, if it was prominent. But in terms of really understanding a rhythm section and hearing how the parts go together and what's the drummer doing here and what's that instrument, it was really a revelation when I started to hear all these things. And I'm fascinated now by going back to music I listened to years ago, and I hear things I never heard before. And it's very much just, even you ask someone the question, well, what do you hear? Okay, well, can you hear this? And they'll say, oh, wow, I never noticed that.
Yeah, right.
And at the same time, to add to that thought, I taught for a number of years in an audio production program. I was teaching a music theory class and then the critical listening class for a while. Now, I'm not trained as an engineer. So some of the things that I was teaching had to do with ear training as far as recognizing frequencies, where if something is woofy, what frequency do you adjust to fix that? If you want to make something sparkle, what frequency do you adjust? And so they had listening exercises where you would just hear white noise and then a particular frequency would be boosted or cut. And it was just interesting to look at ear training from this other sonic perspective instead of the musical perspective. Now, this is a long-winded answer, but I'll come back to saying that I've come to believe that what a natural ear is an intuitive ability to make a connection between a sonic relationship and a physical one on an instrument.
And I like how you say in the book that, yes, some people might be born with that intuitive ability and don't have to think things through, but anybody can learn the thought process for it. And just like a savant might be able to do math problems like in their head without any going through all the motions, but any of us can learn to do those math problems. It just may take us a little longer.
Right. And it's really interesting that you hit on that, because no high school teacher is ever going to say, well, you know, I know you have a talent for algebra, so we're not going to worry about it. You don't need to figure out how to do this. And I can attest to that because my algebra teachers would not let me go. They rode me until I had it right. There's an expectation. Yes, you can learn how to do this, so you're going to. But with music, people feel that it's a zero-sum game. You have it or you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, you talk about the talent trap in the book. And one side of that is this idea that if you aren't born with a certain amount of talent, that you're never going to be able to be a musician. But there's right. the other side of it, too. If you are born with that intuitive ability, it comes very easily to you. There's a trap there, too.
Absolutely, because if you haven't had to work hard to learn it, then when you hit that point where suddenly it is work, it's very frustrating and somebody just might not do it.
Yeah,
it's no different than anything else.
That's true. And another talent trap that I see is I've known people who are very talented, maybe most commonly I'm thinking vocally, and you know, everyone all their life has told them they have this a wonderful voice, which they do, but they're really shocked to think that that doesn't automatically mean they're going to be able to make a living from it. And
well, there's that, yes.
There's that, yes. And the idea of having to work a regular job is just, like, insulting to them.
Yeah. Well, one learns, you know. It's when I mentioned how in my schooling – the only sort of career counseling I got was directly from my teachers if we were having a conversation about it. And that is one thing that has really changed a lot. I mean, I live in Nashville, and so this is a music industry town. And when young people come here, whether they study formally or not, they are neck deep in it. And they're surrounded by people who are trying to figure out how to make a living in a very, very crowded market, and everybody's talented. So then you start to realize, okay, well, what you were gifted with doesn't make you special anymore. So what do you need to concentrate on? And that's where skills come in. That's where professionalism comes in. That's where simply being reliable and understanding how to work with people. There's so much more to it.
Absolutely.
I want to tell you this story. Okay, I was supposed to sing. I was singing, going to sing at this funeral, and I saw the accompanist coming in, and she didn't have any music with her. And I thought, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Because I don't like to look over somebody's shoulder and try to sing. I like, you know. So she asked me what songs I was going to sing, and I told her, and she said, "What key do you want them in?" And I was, mm-hmm. I mean, I know my mouth dropped open because I yeah. thought, oh my gosh. She can play any key, this song in any key, and she doesn't have the music.
Yep.
That is, what a talent.
That's professionalism.
It is, and, yeah. and there's certainly, there is a gift that makes that facility much easier, but I'm really convinced that it's all about relationships. And I think about friends of mine, again, living in an industry town, I know a lot of very talented recording engineers, and many of them are also very good at other kinds of engineering. They're good with their hands. They can build things. I've had a running joke with a friend of mine for years because he was always very good with his hands. And I finally said to him, "So what, do you build bridges too?" And so for years it's been, "Hey, I built a bridge." And I would watch, you know, we'd be on a camping trip and, "Oh, we need a lean-to. Okay, I got this. And all right, now the pieces are in place." I watch people who are handy. I thought for years that I was not mechanically inclined until I finally realized that all mechanisms have a logic that allows them to work. But the skill that these people had that I didn't was the ability to see, here are the pieces, and visualize how they fit. And sometimes when we say someone is mechanically inclined, they can intuitively see the relationships between the different pieces. They can look at a pile of wood and see a house, which is no different than a gifted musician hearing a set of notes and intuitively understanding the relationship between them well enough to go to an instrument and now have a visual and tactile relationship, but be able to easily make that connection. And if you think about being able to play a song in any key, that person is not focused on the notes themselves. They're not thinking about the key signature. They're focusing on the relationship and just shifting it around from one place to another.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Dave Isaacs, author of The Perpetual Beginner, A Musician's Path to Lifelong Learning. So, Dave, would you like to read a little bit from your book?
Sure. So there are chapters that are more story and there are chapters that are more teaching, but it's all a little bit of both. I think I'm going to go to this one because I like the story. And this is one that I wasn't even sure if I was going to put this in the book because I didn't know if it put me in a good light or not. But this is a story of a master class that I performed in when I was just fresh out of school. So I finished my master's degree. And this is called The Purist and the Maverick: Style, Authenticity, and Expression. Classical guitar is a beautiful and fiendishly demanding discipline. I studied seriously for 10 years, and I did well. I graduated first in my class at the Aaron Copland School at the City University of New York. At the Manhattan School of Music, I won the Rose Augustine Award for Promising Young Classical Guitarist twice. I had distinguished myself at a top conservatory among serious guitar students from around the world, and I did love it even when I didn't. But looking back, I realized that I didn't love it with my heart. I loved the idea of being a classical musician, as stodgy as that sounds to most people. The music absolutely did touch me, and I got a great sense of accomplishment from playing it well. But my relationship with the classical guitar was a marriage of convenience. There was certainly affection there, and I thought I could see a life for myself in it. But in retrospect, I think I also saw it as a way to become sophisticated, worldly, and accomplished. It was the next step in my journey of self-discovery, but it was also the next role that I tried on like a new suit to see how it fit. I might have worn it well, but it ultimately wasn't me. You may have never questioned why you play the music you play or how you approach it. Many people are happy just learning songs they love. That simple enjoyment is reason enough. But the music you play can also be part of who you are, and getting to know how to play like you can be the biggest step forward you'll ever take. You can't rasgueado like Gringo. In early 1994, the year after I completed my master's degree, I was accepted to perform in a masterclass at Yale University. The masterclass is a tradition in classical music in which students perform for eminent players for a critique in front of an audience. This could be highly intimidating, especially when playing for a maestro with a reputation for exacting standards. But that's the point, and it's well worth the chance to learn from some of the best musicians in the world. The maestro in this case was an eminent American guitarist, one of the few to attract attention outside of the very closed world of classical guitar. He was a successful concert artist, known both for premiering new music and for his work on film soundtracks, including one with a particular resonance for me and many of my guitar-playing peers who were straddling the worlds of classical and rock music. The class was in the recital hall at the Yale School of Music and featured several students performing for an audience of about 200 guitarists and aficionados. I had played the same piece, a flamenco-influenced sonata by the 20th-century Spanish composer Joaquin Turina, in another masterclass and at my graduation recital from the Manhattan School. I knew the music well and had worked out a careful interpretation. However, there was one important detail that had escaped me: the use of the Spanish strum, or rasgueado. You know the sound. Imagine a dramatically strummed Spanish guitar with the individual fingers of the right hand quickly and repeatedly striking the strings. It's a difficult technique to master, but essential to properly evoke the spirit of flamenco. What I didn't know was that the maestro had studied under Pepe Romero of the celebrated Romero family, titans of Spanish guitar who had fled the Spanish dictator Franco's totalitarian regime in the 50s to settle in California. This should have been a great opportunity to get closer to the source, but I was not mentally prepared for the judgment of a purist. I was never fully comfortable on stage with the classical guitar, and a high-pressure situation only made it worse. My hands were clammy and seemed much further away than usual. I'm sure I wasn't at my best, but it wasn't a disaster. My playing had been acceptable to the other masters I had played for, including the internationally renowned founder of the guitar program at the Juilliard School. So reasonably enough, I thought it was okay, but not this time. The maestro chided me on my strumming technique, then looked knowingly at the audience and said, "You can't rasgueado like Gringo." This got the big laugh he had intended. and I wanted to crawl under my chair. I was so distracted by the feeling of humiliation that I didn't retain anything else he said. But there were lessons to take away. It's worth mentioning again that I had worked on the same piece with two equally eminent experts who had voiced no objections to my technique. But if the music is meant to evoke flamenco, it's reasonable to suggest that it would be better for the technique to be faithful to the style. I could have explored the context of the piece more thoroughly. If I had really done my due diligence, I would have been more aware of what was stylistically appropriate and what wasn't. From the perspective of someone who really knew the style, I hadn't gone deep enough. However, you could also view his perspective as the view of a purist rather than a creative interpreter. My skin should have been a little thicker. I allowed my ego to get in the way, and so I lost the opportunity to really learn something new. I could have chosen to take or leave his input, but I didn't have to take it personally. Regardless, the experience turned out to be my last as a classical musician. Some weeks later, I started to feel an unprecedented level of pain in my hands. Occasional strain was one thing, but this was something else. The pain spread up my arms and into my shoulders and back. The diagnosis was a repetitive strain injury, acute thoracic outlet syndrome, a compression of the nerves between the collarbone and first rib. I quit playing to endure 6 frustrating months of physical therapy and introspection. When I was able to play again, I had to make a choice between the two paths I had explored. Not just the difference between the classical and the electric guitar, but the difference between two competing musical universes. In one, the performance felt like a standard to be met. In the other, it was pure expression, an exploration of the unknown. This is an oversimplification, but viewed in that light, it wasn't a difficult choice.
And that was Dave Isaacs reading from The Perpetual Beginner, A Musician's Path to Lifelong Learning. When you had that stress injury, was there ever, were you afraid that you'd never be able to play up to your previous standard?
Oh, I was afraid I wouldn't be able to play.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been hard.
It was. It was very depressing. It was very challenging. And thankfully, I was able to, I was living at home at the time, so I had a place to stay. And I was still teaching guitar. I just wasn't picking the thing up, really. And I was teaching beginners, so that wasn't a problem. But it was difficult. And I did learn a lot, though, in the process of getting my chops back about how to not fall into that trap again. And when you talk about a situation where someone is practicing 6, 7, 8 hours a day, you are absolutely prone to these kind of things. And I had more peers in school that ended up with different kinds of repetitive injuries than didn't. Because something that intense, you really have to be careful and you have to balance how you use your body. And most 23-year-olds are not living particularly balanced lifestyles.
Well, it can happen later in the career, too, because my friend that I referred to at Berkeley, the professor, was a trombonist, and he developed a stress condition that affected his embouchure, and he could never really play again.
Yeah.
Or at least not professionally.
Yeah. Right. And it really depends on how severe, what the injury is, how severe it is. There is a, actually the current head of the guitar program at Manhattan School, David Leisner, who came up as a concert artist in the 70s, developed a dystonia, which is a tremor, in, I believe, in his picking hand, and had to quit performing. And this is while I was in school, so it was a story that everybody knew. And he has since gone on to be a renowned expert on how to solve these problems. And he is giving concerts again. So it's good to know that someone who was at that level was able to come back from that kind of an injury. But you hear stories like that. I mean, and not even with repetitive strain. I mean, the jazz guitarist Pat Martino had a brain aneurysm and completely lost the ability to play and had to relearn it again.
Mm,
and you hear about, you know, all kinds of things.
Wow. And you don't think of music as a dangerous profession.
No, although I've been told that in actuarial tables, according to the insurance industry, it is.
Yeah, well, that might have a different underlying cause.
Yes, I think so. But it's yeah. it's true.
Yeah.
Because people don't think of playing music as an athletic activity. But if you look at the kind of focus that a serious music student is putting in and the amount of work that those muscles are getting.
I know when I watch, for example, an orchestra and I watch the violinists, how I'm thinking their arms have to be really strong. You know,
at the same time, it's also, and this was one of the big insights, I think, for me in recovering from the injury. And, you know, this is now 30 years later. So it's, you know, obviously I still have chronic issues that come and go, but I can manage them. And you learn, and I would say that this applies to any good musician, how to move the body with as little effort as possible. And you can learn this from athletes, because athletes certainly develop the musculature, but it's the movement that creates the fluidity and the flow that you see in these performances. You watch gymnasts, you know, but even you watch boxers, though, how light these big guys can be on their feet. And you can apply the concept to almost anything, to a golf swing, to playing tennis, that if you're working the muscles too hard, you're actually working against yourself.
And you have a whole chapter in the book, Instrument and Body, Creating a Mental Map,
yes.
about using your body as a musician. Is this
yes.
Does this surprise people that, you know, that you are addressing that in here? Or do musicians know that the body is part of their instrument?
Depends on their training. I think a lot of people are surprised, or at least it's something that they might have never thought about. Definitely in my teaching work now, particularly since I work with so many songwriters, people that picked up the guitar specifically as a tool for writing. So they are not performance oriented in the same way. And you'll get your basic mechanics together and then everything stops. And so they're playing with these problems, or let's just say they're playing with habits they've developed that are getting in the way, but don't know it. And so you could say, do you know you're holding your breath when you do that? And they go, really? Or have you ever looked at your face in the mirror while you're trying to do that strum? You're clearly working very hard. Oh, I never noticed that. Your left hand is gripping. Oh, yeah, I noticed that. But they don't. It's not something people think about unless you've had some experience in your life of being very clear about directing your body and observing what's going on. So the fact that I had experience studying yoga, I had experience studying the Alexander technique, and that I had a process of being able to do an internal check and talking about that body map. What are my shoulders doing? My Alexander teacher would say things like, can you ask your right shoulder to let go? And at first I thought, well, what does that even mean? But when I ask someone to do that and they think, okay, let me try it, I say, just think about your shoulder while you're playing. And suddenly everything changes. And people are always amazed by it.
Yeah, I found this section on the Alexander technique really interesting. I had not heard of that, but
no, here.
The Alexander technique is something that I actually started studying because I had heard of it as something that people do to improve their posture. And I still have a guitarist slouch, but I was completely unaware of it, or not very aware of it when I was much younger. And I started working with a teacher, Chloe Wing, who was absolutely fantastic, and she really became a mentor to me. But the basic concept behind Alexander technique, and this is something that was codified by I believe he was an Austrian actor, and it has to do with how one carries the body. And the basic premise is that the structure of the human body is such that the body itself could be self-supporting, but that over the course of a lifetime, we develop these chronic tensions and forms of armoring where muscles lock up, sometimes even because of psychological factors that throw us off balance. And so what Alexander technique does is it aligns the body through aligning the skeleton internally. it's not all that different from the philosophy behind chiropractic work, except that a chiropractor makes an instant adjustment and Alexander work is a gentle coaxing into alignment over time. By manipulating the skeleton and the way the body is held, the muscles then begin to readjust around that. And it's something that dancers study, and it is something that a lot of music schools do offer now. And it is absolutely, I think, the reason I can still play.
So, Dave, why don't you tell us a little bit about how the book is structured, what's in here, and what a reader can hope to get from it?
Well, the book is what I'm calling an instructional memoir, which is not technically a genre, but I'm seeing that I've read quite a few books that sort of follow this model, which essentially means that you tell a story and then extract the moral and say, this is how this lesson that I learned in this instance applies to how I, or rather, this lesson is important because I use these ideas, these techniques, these skills every day, and here's how they can help you. So each chapter, most of them, start off with a story, and then from that story, pulling out a core idea and then exploring a lesson about how that idea can be applied.
And so what are some of the kind of the core ideas that you're developing here?
Well, there's really one for each chapter. One, when I talked about becoming obsessed and falling in love with the guitar, I think it's important for people to ask themselves, well, what makes you want to do this? What motivates you? And can you really make an effort to connect with those things? And when I really started to look at what was motivating, I think ultimately it is that music connects us. It connects us to other people when we perform. It connects us to other musicians when we play. It connects us to our own emotions, to other experiences we might have had. It's really connected. It's intricately bound up with that part of us. And it's the reason schools have fight songs. It's the reason people sing at stadiums, right? So that's, I think if someone is finding that their motivation is flagging, that they're disconnected. And so you want to find a way to do that. We talked about the talent trap, how one's perception of one's latent ability can really be an anchor that holds you back. Instrument and body, the core idea is that your body is part of how you play, and you need to be aware of more of it than your hands. Chapter on practicing gives you a very detailed method of how one might break down a practice process. The chapter I read from ultimately ends up being about whether one chooses, and this is for someone who is further along in the process, but whether one chooses to be completely faithful to the way the music you love was played, or whether you allow yourself to find your own way to do it. And there's a later chapter in the book that addresses specifically people that are developing as artists, as creative musicians, rather than as people who can reproduce something on command. And how I realized one day that my training was perfect for learning how to be a professional musician and having the skills I needed to make a living in different musical settings. But it was not great training for being an artist, because you didn't necessarily learn how to really dig into yourself and find what your version of expression was. And of course, that has to come later than the process of developing a working classical musician's technical abilities, because you don't get to pick the notes. You have to be able to play whatever the composer is asking you to play. But in popular music,
of course,
virtually every musician that has ever inspired me, most of them do one thing in a highly compelling way. And some of those players can do lots of different things, but most of them, they do what they do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really telling, because I look back and I had there's a chapter in the book about this as well, that in my career as a performer, I've been interested in so many different things that I was really sort of all over the map. Explore this, explore that. And I think ultimately it was a detriment to that side of things, because I didn't figure out who I was before I put it out there. And, or I thought I did, you know, but, it was not the same as, and as I've mentioned before, I work with a lot of people who are developing artist careers, and the ones that are doing the best and the ones that I think are going to go the furthest are the ones that A, work the hardest, but B, are very clear about who they are and what their territory is. And then once you're established as a performer, you can always choose to go someplace else, but you can't, as someone pointed out to me once, you can't cross over from nowhere. You have to start somewhere.
And also, sometimes audiences aren't very receptive to people not doing what is known, what they're known for. And sure. I know that can be frustrating for the performers. They want to do something new, something different, and the audience is like, no, we want your old stuff.
Right. Or, you know, it's like there's a lot of music that's perpetuated by a museum culture that, you know, there's an ongoing sort of two competing schools in virtually any kind of music with roots. But talk about the blues, for example. And you have people that are straight up purists because they want to learn how to play acoustic blues from the 1920s. And this is the style. And if that's what they fell in love with, that's wonderful. But when someone says to you, oh, no, you can't play it that way because that's not how Blind Lemon Jefferson played it. These people were innovators. I mean, Muddy Waters was a maverick. He created something new. He invented something. You can't turn around and tell me, oh, you have to do it just like Muddy did, because Muddy wouldn't have done it just like Muddy.
Well, Dave, this has been a real pleasure, but we're out of time. And we've been talking today about The Perpetual Beginner, A Musician's Guide to Lifelong Learning with Dave Isaacs. And I had all kinds of more questions about the writing of the book, but I guess we'll have to leave that for another time.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
I do. This is comes from my heart. Music to me is the voice of the soul. From the magnificent creations of the past by Bach and Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, to the present. So let's all enjoy the music of this world.
Well, thank you. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.